Welcome to History and D&D. In the last episode, I discussed some of my influences and go-to information sources. In this episode, I'll discuss big campaigns and how the desire to run them is the same sentiment that led to and coincided with massively multiplayer online role-playing games. In March 1977, Keith A. Abbott, from Michigan, wrote to Dragon Magazine No. 5 and outlined a massive campaign. He wanted 55 Dungeon Masters to each run a 600 by 600 mile region of his campaign setting called Loera. He ran full-page advertisements for Loera in prominent fanzines like The Dungeoneer around the beginning of 1977. There's no information that I could find on whether or how many people joined his campaign, if it ran, or how long it ran. So far, it's just one letter and a few ads and fanzines from the 70s suggesting something similar to a massively multiplayer online role-playing game of today. There was a 50-page Loerian supplement you could buy, but again, little mention that it was actually running at full tilt or anything like that. I scoured Google to find anything I could about this game, but like I said, there's nothing to find. At least that's what it seems. What I did find were some inferences that Keith may have helped spawn the D&D Adventures League, or at least he might have helped create material for a prototype of it. Now, Keith Abbott is listed as an author in issue 77 of Knights of the Dinner Table magazine. I don't know if this Keith Abbott or the others I'll mention are the same person. I just think they may be. There's a Tunnel and Trolls Weird World solo adventure by Keith Abbott. Tunnels and Trolls was the second role-playing game published after Dungeons & Dragons. The game supported play-by-mail, which is something suggested in Keith's letter. There's also a Keith A. Abbott listed as production staff on The Day of the Dwarf and Wedding Day. Both are from the RPG Living City Adventures from 2000. This RPGA, or Role-Playing Game Association, was part of the organized play arm of TSR, then Wizards of the Coast. The RPGA started in 1980. It ran organized play, including tournaments, and created a living campaign in 1987. This was the beginning of Living City, and the members of the RPGA all affected the outcome of the campaign story arc. The Living City concept sounds very much like what Keith's letter suggested. Wizards of the Coast replaced the RPGA with Adventures League in 2014. What is today called Adventures League comes out of the tradition of wanting a large organized structure in which players are interconnected despite their geographical location. The first attempt at this was the Role-Playing Game Association, or RPGA, created in 1980 by Frank Mentzer, an employee of TSR. It was initially started to run tournament games at convention. Convention play is an animal unto itself, as there are restrictions on the gameplay out of necessity. For one, there's a strict time limit on the table, whereas at a home game, you could play without any prearranged schedule. Also, you're playing with strangers, and the character you play in a single session, for the most part, is probably never played by you again. But what I find strangest of all is the word tournament, and the competitive aspect. There's no objective measurement for playing a game like this, so any winning or losing is subjective, and yet, the tournaments at the convention post lists of winners, despite the impossibility of accurately measuring such a thing. In the 80s, the RPGA ran such tournaments. In 1987, it began what was called a living campaign. This meant that character actions would have an impact on the overall story arc. The first living campaign was set in the living city of Raven's Bluff. The campaign was run at that year's Gen Con. Now, instead of playing brand new pre-generated characters that didn't advance, players made their own character that continued through the story. Players would send the results of their sessions to the RPGA, and the story would shift based on what was accomplished by the majority of the groups. When 3rd edition D&D was released, the RPGA shifted its focus to a new setting, Living Greyhawk, from 2000 to 2008. The final Greyhawk adventures were released at Origins in 2008 after 4th edition was announced. But information on the Living campaign is still available on the Wizards of the Coast website. After 4th edition came out, Ashes of Athas, a new Living campaign announced in 2010 and set in the Darksane campaign, was launched at the Winter Fantasy Convention in 2011. It ran until 2013. Fifth Edition began playtesting in that year and would release in 2014, which is when the RPGA finally ended. It was replaced with Adventures League, which focused more on local game store play than on convention play at first. This was probably due to the branding success Wizards of the Coast had had with Friday Night Magic, which is a weekly event for the card game Magic the Gathering at game stores almost everywhere. Adventures League was divided into several categories of play. Encounters is the use of a large module at the local store level over several sessions of about 10 to 20 weeks, usually one per season, which are 6 months to a year. Expeditions are multiple modules that are released for convention or store play. More than a dozen are released per season. Casual allows home or club play of large hardcover campaigns and smaller modules to be reported through a local game store. Epics are played exclusively at convention. Some of this structure may have changed over the years since, but what hasn't is the interconnected nature of these adventures and the players who run through them. There's a logging system that allows your character achievements and activities to be tracked within the overall structure as a way of accounting, and this allows you to move your character from one session to another with the same or different players from region to region. But this logging is not recorded in a centralized database by Wizards. It's just signed off by a DM as it's added to your sheet. Encounters and expeditions used to be supplied for free to stores, but now need to be purchased through a website called DM's Guild, because Wizards licensed the product to a third party. This means creators can potentially make more money for their adventures than they would have when they were paid directly by Wizards. From what I can tell, Living City began the living campaign concept officially for D&D. Maybe with some insight from Luera and other players with a desire to create something larger. Living Greyhawk took this to an apex before it ended, and it seems that it was more robust, immersive, and open-ended than online video games that followed. But it was probably a logistical nightmare. So Adventures League seems to be a step back from Living Greyhawk, and more like the MMOs since World of Warcraft, but probably less grindy with a slightly more interactive world. It's more organized play than it is Living Campaign. For some deep crunch, it's more like Magic the Gathering than it is like Legend of the Five Rings. Basically, your character advances and can easily move from table to store to club to meetup to online and convention, and the storylines can be affected by groups reporting their play. But your character is a bit of an island because there's no official centralized system recording progress and comparing individuals. A simple solution to this would be to just have Wizards or D&D Beyond centralize all characters in their system. D&D Beyond makes the most sense because it's pretty much already doing this with its toolset. I was fascinated by the following story when I first came across it. Jason Hashimoto and Robert Warbaugh spoke to Dragon Talk in June of 2016 to discuss what is considered to be the longest-running D&D campaign. Robert had been running the campaign for 34 years by that point, which would put the start date at 1982 when he was 14. He began the game in a small town in Saskatchewan. He had first played with a beginner's box, as he describes it, but a friend took that home. So as he built out his campaign, he had only a DM's guide and a monster manual. Without the player's handbook, he had to reverse engineer and homebrew the rules. He has also added rules from various editions of D&D as he came across them. In what he calls the first phase, from 1982 to when he went to college, he used modules to flesh out the adventure, and the locations in those modules became the early basis for the campaign. The framework of the world and its history was Earth, with these added locations. Over time, more fictional worlds merged with the campaign. He didn't have access to a game setting when he first created the world, so it became a mishmash of various worlds. Because he saw Greyhawk mentioned many times in early D&D materials, he called it the Realm of the Greyhawk. He includes concepts from fiction, such as Middle-earth, Hyboria, a Fremen society, the Underdark, and Menzor Baranzan, all on a pre-gunpowder Earth. Characters die a great deal in this game, and many times they die of old age. When a player wants to make a new character in the world, they have to do so with the children, grandchildren, or other progeny of previous player characters. Some dynasties of characters are 20 generations long. And now, the real-life children of its earliest players are starting to join. the oldest currently active player of this campaign go back to 1985. The longest he's gone without playing is 3 weeks. He often plays with 10 to 12 players at a time, and there are more than 50 players that come in and out of each session. Jason joined the game sometime around 2006. He describes it as playing in the NFL of game tables. Robert says he wanted some game that was so awesome that it would keep his friends in contact, because he saw that often people drift apart if nothing keeps them together. There are players on the West and East Coasts and Midwest of North America and the UK. For players who are at the table sessions, they play the game. For those that are not, he has them tracked to where they were last in the world. The characters have pendants that allow teleportation to anyone else who has a pendant. Jason documents the campaign on an Instagram account called the_gamednd. I'm not going over all these huge games to suggest that smaller games are inferior. In fact, most of the D&D games I played in my youth were basically one-shots. My friends and I would make a new character every day, regardless of whether the previous ones had died, which they often did. With these new characters, at whatever level we chose, we'd set out on a fresh new adventure. It wasn't until recently that we even leveled up a character, so I see nothing wrong with smaller campaigns and adventures that don't have an epic scope. The game's fun, no matter how you choose to play it. My preference is rules as written, or raw, with homebrew as necessary, but almost complete homebrew for the campaign setting and story. That's how I play most of my games. It's much easier to blend in character expectations and goals when you have a broad framework for your world and they explore their options. I hold on to the idea that everyone has to have fun in the way they want to have fun, as long as they all recognize that their expectations do not trample on others. That means every player and the DM has an equal share in the fun, and any player that fails to recognize that other people are trying to have fun playing this game need to be reminded that the game isn't just for them. One of the best games I played was at the end of GaryCon 1 year. My friend Sean and I were getting ready to head home that Sunday afternoon as things were winding down. We saw a group of young adults gathering with a DM our age at a table across from us. He had set up this elaborate temple set with demons and priests. It was a pretty cool 3D piece, and we asked to join. He handed us some character sheets and then began. I was a halfling rogue, Sean was a barbarian. The other members clustered in advance as I spotted an important future threat. There was a roper at the far edge of where the demons and the party would end up clashing, and a spike pit between the roper and that battleground. So I stealthed towards it as quickly as I could, using the cliffs at the edge of the map as cover. A demon flew past me, so I sacrificed getting closer to the roper to go in for a sneak attack. As the demon flew away to engage my party, I realized an opportunity. I was equipped with a luck blade with one wish, so I asked the DM, would I be able to differentiate between the different species in this room, which are demons and which are fiends? He said I would, because the party had been fighting all kinds of creatures from the Nine Hells for a long while. So I asked him to identify which creatures were demons. After he pointed to them, I said, I wish all the demons in this room were my loyal allies. The others looked at me, and one said something like, wow, that's crazy. Sean and I looked at each other knowingly, because they were young and maybe this didn't strike them as the very first thing you'd wish for in this situation, but maybe our long experience had turned it into second nature. So the DM decided the demons would make saving throws, and any that failed would be controlled by me. Meanwhile, Sean had flanked around to the sacrificial pool for the secret mission of his own, and had just finished dealing with another roper on the other side. As the demons came under my control, I turned them against the creatures attacking my party and the head priest. Meanwhile, Sean slew most of the other priests with a javelin of lightning. Now, not all the demons came under my control. It was a very high DC, or technically low DC. Basically, it was easy for the demons to succeed, but two of them did, one of which was nearly dead anyway. But it was fun to have made a crazy wish. The battle tipped quickly in our favor, and then Orcus arrived. I stealthed towards the roper, that I had focused on and rolled a natural 20 on my attack. It went down, and now everyone was free to focus on the Demon Lord. It was still a hard-pressed fight, but Sean was able to land the killing blow with his own natural 20. This unexpected one-shot game is probably in my top 10 sessions, if not my top 5. The DM of this game was a wonderful guy and very good at running a game. He's Matt Rauscher of the Pickled Dragon on Instagram. One of the players was Kelsey Dion of the Arcane Library on Instagram. Both of them sell adventures and other products for D&D on either DM's Guild or their website. I suggest looking them up. If you're starting out, you can create your own campaign from scratch. I suggest starting as small as you can. Matt Colville's Running the Game playlist on YouTube is a great asset to help you get started. Once you feel comfortable, you can continue by homebrewing your own adventures, or you can get official ones from Wizards of the Coast. I have most of them and may never run them, but at the very least, they are excellent resources for expanding on your own creativity. Wizards of the Coast has released many adventure books that also tie into the Adventures League play, so the adventures can be part of a massive storyline. All of these 50th edition adventures are valuable. The starter set has a simple adventure called Lost Mines of Phandelver, designed to help new players. Horde of the Dragon Queen and Rise of Tiamat are two parts of a massive campaign called Tyranny of Dragons. From what I gather, it's similar to the War of the Lance from Dragonlance, but set in the Forgotten Realms. Princes of the Apocalypse is an elemental evil story. This story is based on classic D&D. The Temple of Elemental Evil was an adventure module published in 1985 as a follow-up to The Village of Homlet from 1979, and this storyline is the basis of many early D&D campaigns. My own group of friends ran through this many times. Not sure if we ever did it successfully. The Rage of Demons story delves into the Underdark in the Out of the Abyss book. Players start off as prisoners, and after they escape the Drow, they have to make their way through the dangers of the Underdark, slowly discovering that there are also demon lords to deal with. Curse of Strahd is another classic story. It began in 1983 with a module by Tracy and Laura Hickman and evolved into a campaign setting of its own. Ravenloft is a realm of horrors where evil entities, such as the vampire Count Strahd, have been banished, and the mists from this realm transport the unwary from other places into this place of nightmares. You can't have a D&D adventure without eventually running into giants. And a campaign that deals with Rampage and Giants comes from the very beginnings of D&D, starting with the module from 1978, Studying of the Hill Giant Chief. This time, the story is called Storm King's Thunder, and it takes place directly after Tyranny of Dragons. Tales from the Yawning Portal is a collection of one-shot adventures that are adaptations of various popular adventures from each edition of D&D. Tomb of Annihilation is a jungle temple delve. It's notable for the associated Stream of Annihilation, which was a massive live play event sponsored by Wizards of the Coast and featuring the most popular Twitch streamers all playing the new adventure at a single event over a 3-day period. Waterdeep is maybe the single most important city in D&D, so a storyline based around it is always welcome. The two books Dragon Heist and Dungeon of the Mad Mage explore the city above and the dungeon below. Dragon Heist especially was raved about. There's a Stranger Things box set for D&D, and it includes an adventure called Hunt for the Thessal Hydra. The Ghosts of Saltmarsh is a collection of sea-based adventures adapted from various older modules through D&D history. The Essentials Kit is an update of the Starter Kit and includes an adventure called Dragon of Icespire Peak. Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus is a campaign where the players have to make difficult choices and avoid corruption. They eventually descend into the Nine Hells. So, there's a crossover called Dungeons & Dragons vs. Rick and Morty, and it contains an adventure titled The Lost Dungeon of Rickiness, Big Rick Energy. Oh man. Oh jeez. Gee whiz. That's crazy. I think it's pretty well established that D&D eventually led to an evolution in video games. It spawned both RPGs and their derivative, massively multiplayer online role-playing games. The sentiment that led to MMOs, I think, is well entrenched in the very beginning of tabletop role-playing games, and that all started with Dungeons & Dragons. You could tell by reading old materials and talking with old grognards that there was always a desire to try to make the game bigger and bigger. One day, maybe we'll see someone innovate some system that creates this crazy interconnected worldwide campaign. One game to rule them all, and in the darkness, bind them. In the next episode, I'll discuss the various concepts of role-playing as they pertain to Dungeons & Dragons. This has been History and D&D. Hadad, I hope your day is free of thunderbolts.